From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. It seems so simple, but can so easily elude us, noticing the quiet, the surprising, the graceful, the moments of delight that abound each day. Can we become more aware of delight with practice? Poet Ross Gay gave himself a year-long task each day to fine-tune his radar for delight, to observe the small, caretaking gestures that connect us, and to handwrite a short essay. He reads from the result, the Book of Delights, and implores readers to slow down and savor the little things.
I would be glad if, to some extent, people felt maybe even more inclined to sort of recognize the sweetness of our daily lives. And, crucially, how interdependent we are.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. When was the last time you felt delighted? Do you remember what evoked the feeling? Do you ever wonder how to tempt more delight into your life? Back in February, we spoke with poet Ross Gay, who has meditated on these questions intensely. He recorded his observations and experiences in The Book of Delights, a collection of short essays. Gay has also published three books of poetry, Against Which, Bringing the Shovel Down, and Catalogue of Unabashed Gratitude. That collection won the 2015 National Book Critics Circle Award and the 2016 Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award. I asked him what compelled him to write The Book of Delights.
You know, I was just walking through a field with, I was walking home. I was actually in Italy. I was at a writing residency in Italy, and I was walking through a field, and there were wildflowers, and there was, you know, wild fennel, I think, growing on the side of the road, and, you know, honeybees and other kinds of bees, probably. And I thought, well, this is delightful. I should write a little something about this. And then I thought, you know, it'd be interesting if I actually wrote about something that delighted me every day for a year. It sort of came to me quickly, and I thought, that'd be an interesting project. Maybe I'll try that.
Well, you start the book out describing some of the rules you gave yourself for the creation of it. Why rules?
I think the rules are that I had to write them quickly. I had to write them by hand, I needed to do them by daily. And I think the idea of the rules was to sort of, one, to make it manageable, you know, so that I was just sort of doing it daily. But I think that also was the intention, was to make it kind of a discipline and a practice. So every day, I knew that every single day part of my work was going to be to attend to something that delighted me that day.
Did you stick to all the rules?
Pretty close. You know, I didn't write them every single day. I came pretty close. But, you know, I probably wrote in the upper 200s or nearly 300 of them. I always wrote by hand. I wrote them quickly. I definitely, you know, I drafted them quickly. I spent a lot of time sort of making the ones that I chose to include in the book better.
Writing in longhand, why is that important?
You know, I think part of it, like, I started to realize this as I got further along in the project, and one of the delights is actually about writing by hand, is that I thought there was something really moving and important about letting my body be as close to the thinking as possible and as close to the expression as possible. So by writing by hand, it's a less mediated way of sort of communicating my thoughts as opposed to writing by a computer. And I also love the idea that when writing by hand, you have this whole sort of archive of your body, what your body has done, and you can kind of refer back to the things. You're not going to you can't delete what you've written, right, by hand. And I kind of love that.
You can cross it out.
And that's part of the archive. And that's among the most beautiful sort of, you know, remnants of writing that I think of when I see things that are crossed out or scribbled or things on top of other things or several word choices, that kind of thing. I love that.
In the piece titled Stacking Delights, you explore the concept of the dailiness of this exercise. Why was the dailiness important?
Well, again, it's sort of that thing of wanting to see what happens if it becomes a practice and if it is a discipline. So, you know, the discipline of studying every single day something that delights you is, it's kind of like working out. You know, I've spent a lot of years being an athlete and coaching. And the thing, and it feels like, and I mentioned this in the introduction, that it feels like there's a kind of muscle being developed. And it, you know, it's like the first time I, or the first, I don't know, 2 weeks that I was writing these things, I was kind of like, okay, I got to look really hard for delight. And then shortly after that, it was kind of like my eyes were sort of opened in this different way, you know? And so the stacking of delights, it's this essay where I sort of talk about, I've been accumulating, just writing down, constantly writing down these things. Oh, that's delightful, that's delightful, that's delightful. And then the stacking of delights is actually this essay where I talk about how lovely it is to sort of clear the delights, because accumulating them or like stashing them is not the objective. The objective is to do it daily.
Not to hoard them, but to share them.
Not to hoard them, but to share them. That's right.
That's author and poet Ross Gay discussing his latest work, The Book of Delights, here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Let's hear something from The Book of Delights. Will you read The Sanctity of Trains?
I'd love to. The Sanctity of Trains. Something I've noticed riding on Amtrak trains, like the one I'm on right now between Syracuse and Manhattan, is that people leave their bags unattended for extended periods of time. Maybe they go to the end of the car to use the bathroom, or sometimes they go to the far end of the train to the cafe, which smells vomity like microwave cheese. My neighbor on this train, across the aisle and one row up, disappeared for a good 20 minutes, her bag wide open, a computer peeking out. Not that I was checking. She is not unusual in this flaunting of security, otherwise known as trust, on the train. Nearly everyone participates in this practice of trust, and without recruiting a neighbor across the aisle to, quote, keep an eye on my stuff while I use the restroom, which seems to be a coffee shop phenomenon. Trusting one's coffee shop neighbor, but not the people in line, etc. I suppose, given the snugness of a train, especially if it's full, one might speculate there's a kind of eyes-on-the-streetness at play, although it seemed to me, this morning, when I was first leaving my valuables on my seat for pilfering, my laptop and cell phone glittering atop my sweatshirt and scarf, most everyone was sleeping, and so provided little, if any, eyewitness deterrent. I suppose I could spend time theorizing how it is that people are not bad to each other, but that's really not the point. The point is that in almost every instance of our lives, our social lives, we are, if we pay attention, in the midst of an almost constant, if subtle, caretaking, holding open doors, offering elbows at crosswalks, letting someone else go first, helping with the heavy bags, reaching what's too high or what's been dropped, pulling someone back to their feet, stopping at the car wreck, at the struck dog, the alternating merge, also known as the zipper. This caretaking is our default mode, and it's always a lie that convinces us to act or believe otherwise. Always.
We're in the midst of an almost constant caretaking. Such a lovely thought. But the last line, it's always a lie that convinces us to act otherwise. What do you mean by that?
You know, I feel like our inclination to not be generous or open or tending or trusting comes from the lie that we are not to be, that we are not generous or caretaking or loving, or, you know, that's the thing. And even when I act ungenerous or uncaretaking, it's almost always as a sort of defense against the prospect of someone else acting ungenerous or uncaretaking. You know what I mean?
It's to ward it off somehow.
It's to ward it off. Yeah.
Would you read Coffee Without the Saucer?
Yeah. Coffee Without the Saucer. It might be what one calls a fetish, though don't get excited, for there are no feet or other body parts involved. Rather, I want to extol the virtues of the small coffee drink, espresso, short Americano, cortado, served without the saucer. Another delight, the song on the radio, Uncle Albert, Admiral Halsey, that weirdest of songs, creepy even, that my brother and I would play again and again on the Fisher-Price record player in our room, one of a handful of Beatles-ish 45s we inherited from our uncle, not deceased. I'm thinking of this delight as I wobble across this Greenwich Village cafe called Stumptown, my short Americano wobbling precariously on the little saucer until I can rescue it and place it squarely on the table. Phew! And the spoon clanging the whole time, for Pete's sake. The most recent delightful experience of a saucerless administration of a small coffee drink happened at an espresso place I love not only for the very fine small coffee drinks they make, but also for the curiosity of one barista in particular, who studies my face as I indulge. No saucer, right? She observed after one visit. I love her. But it's her compatriot I'm today lauding, a French-looking college kid. French-looking, indulge my stupidity here. By the high-waisted pants and sort of orderly, disordered look. A scarf, no beret. When she opened her mouth, though, it was obvious that if she was from Bayonne, it was the one in Jersey. Anyway, she pulled the double espresso and without even reaching, without even glancing, beneath the counter where the useless and actually truly dangerous saucers are stacked, think of the natural resources wasted in their productions, little discuses of evil. She just placed the demitasse, holding it not by the handle, but sort of clutching it from above, like the magical mechanical claw in those rest stop games, in front of me, all French-like, pretending she wasn't my sister, which she was.
I love the description. A lot of these essays feel like they're centered in slowing down enough to notice delight.
I think that's exactly right. So often the way that the looking happens is this book is exactly that. It's this sort of I might be in a place where some of them happen in airplanes and I'm sort of looking around the airplane, seeing what's happening, or some of them will happen sitting down at a coffee shop or in a park or walking through a park in a way sort of, you know, being able to be undistracted in a certain kind of way. And that idea of like having a moment to sort of extend and to meditate on is often what's happening, you're right.
That's author and poet Ross Gay. Quick break here, and then more from The Book of Delights. I'm Sheila Cast. He's staying with us. Hope you will too.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. This morning, we're revisiting a conversation from February about delight. Specifically, The Book of Delights, a collection of short essays by poet Ross Gay. He spent a year, from his 42nd birthday to his 43rd, searching for and writing about delightful things he experienced or witnessed each day. I asked him to read the essay Found Things from around the middle of that year.
Found Things. Among the qualities of delight, I'm finding, in my dalliance with it, T-shirt, dalliance with delight, is the feeling of discovery, the sense that one has found something, been shown something, perhaps materially, perhaps spiritually or psychically, that was previously unknown. Perhaps delight is like a great cosmic finger pointing at something. That's not it. Perhaps delight is like after the great cosmic finger has pointed at something, and that something, which in all likelihood was already there, which is why I've enlisted a cosmic finger rather than a human one, appears. Aha, or whoa, yes. For instance, when a couple days back, I saw a husky middle-aged man pulling his roller bag down the block with wheels that sparkled, which are in the same aesthetic ballpark as the children's sneakers that do the same, I thought, whoa, yes, much the way I do when I see the kids with firefly feet, Or when I learn from a Thomas Lux poem that pigs cannot look up. Aha! Or when I see birds swooping through the Detroit airport, which I happen to fly through sort of regularly, because I don't see them every time and forget that I see them sometimes, I always, not almost always, always lose my with glee. My finger, also a kind of bird, flying from my side to point at the little tuft that just skidded onto the trash can. Whoa, yes! I also notice myself looking around, searching among the commuters for fellow compatriots of glee. I wonder if this impulse to share, the urge to elbow your neighbor, who maybe was not even your neighbor until the bird flew between you up into the pipes and rafters you did not notice until you followed the bird there, is also among the qualities of delight. And further, I wonder if this impulse suggests, and this is just a hypothesis, though I suspect there is enough evidence to make it a theorem, that our delight grows as we share it.
So did you ever act on that impulse to share the delight you witnessed?
And how constantly. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, how did that play out?
Well, that's what this book is, actually. I mean, so many friends where I live in Bloomington and other places, too, I'd write a delight and then I'd see them walking down the street. I'm like, hey, I got to. So that was like part of my experience for the year was part of a lot of my friends' experiences for the year.
So you didn't save it all you didn't do it all in writing. You did it in the moment.
Yeah, I did it in the moment. And I would also, if I did transcribe it quickly, I would, you know, transcribe a thing or make a brief essay. I was always grabbing my friends and reading them these delights, you know.
Well, did
whether they had to be somewhere or not, you know.
Did people ever think you were just kind of crazy?
You know, sometimes I'd be trying to wrangle something into a delight, and they'd be like, man, you're trying hard on this one, you know.
Well, is it still a delight if you have to work at it?
I think so. I think that's part of the pleasure, is sort of trying to turn something around until you can see something that even tangentially connected to it is delightful. You know, I have this one about bindweed, a plant in the garden that is not much beloved. And, you know, I try to figure it out. I try to make it into a delight.
How else has working on this book affected your life?
Well, I do think that there's something like real about the practice of, you know, I was so lucky. I felt so lucky at some point when I was writing this book. I realized that my work, my job.
Which is both poet and a teacher at Indiana
University.
Yeah,
exactly. Exactly, right. And as a teacher means also being a model for how we might be able to think about writing and making work, that part of my work was to think about what brings me joy or, you know, delight, which is sort of to me under the sort of umbrella of joy. And so that was that in doing that, you know, sort of steadily and doing that for my work and doing that as a daily practice, it really did sort of make me it made me realize many things. But one of the things is that I'm sort of constantly in the midst of this, you know, kind of care and kind of tenderness and kind of sweetness. You know, if I can sort of attend to it, it's constantly happening. And then, you know, at the same time, so it occurred to me that studying delight makes me more aware of our potential for tenderness and the fact of our tenderness. And the fact of our tenderness brings me great delight. So there's this kind of circle of delight that happens. The other thing that I discovered that I think is probably one of the most sort of important discoveries of my life, if not my writing life, if not my life period, is that I'm invested in studying joy. With my work, I want to sort of constantly be thinking about, meditating on, trying to understand joy.
Perfect time to ask you to read Babies seriously.
Oh, yeah. Babies. Seriously. Today, while I was reading on the airplane with my knees smashed into the seat in front of me, a toddler toddled down the aisle in her pink onesie with the panda head hood. She was a remarkably postured little creature, like so many of her ilk, and bold, toddling toward the back of the plane in front of her mother, who was doing a good job of letting the tot explore. But as the baby got near my row, the man in front of me with his sleeping mask slid up on his forehead, widened his eyes, and smiled manically, making kissy noises at the baby. He spoke a language I didn't understand, but the sounds he was making to this baby, which, with his traveling companions, became a chorus of sounds, made me wonder if baby talk is a universal or universalish language, for I understood exactly what they were saying, and how nice of God to make this exception around the language adults speak to babies. Anyhow, the man was so enchanted with this petite creature with wisps of hair feathering north and big eyes that he couldn't resist first poking the child's tummy before scooping the squirt onto his knee, where she stood, bouncing and grinning, looking back to her mom, who looked a touch nervous, before being set free and retreating back down the aisle and returning again, upon which the choir of babbling would commence. Everyone reaching toward the munchkin. Picture the halftime show at a basketball game when the mascot bazookas t-shirts into the crowd, scooping her up and again, until I was so flabbergasted by the endurance of love and delight incited by this child to whom I presume none of these people was related, a love and delight that seemed analogous to the one that makes some people struggle not to eat the faces of babies, that I found myself, despite the very engrossing book I was reading about something horrible, laughing out loud and babbling with them and convinced again of something deeply good in us.
Many of these essays, like this one, have an undertone of humankind is good. Do you think you gave yourself this year-long assignment in order to be reminded of that?
I don't know that that was an objective when I set out. In fact, I don't think it was. But over the course of writing them, I think that was very much, that became very much part of what I was in fact seeing.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with poet and author Ross Gay about The Book of Delights, his collection of short essays. His poem, Becoming a Horse, was chosen by U.S. Poet Laureate Tracy K. Smith for inclusion in American Journal, 50 Poems for Our Time. Becoming a horse is such a visceral portrayal of empathy. Would you read that to us?
Yeah, I'd love to. Becoming a horse. It was dragging my hands along its belly, loosing the bit and wiping the spit from its mouth that made me a snatch of grass in the thing's maw, a fly tasting its ear. It was touching my nose to his that made me know the clover's bloom, my wet eye to his that made me know the long field's secrets. But it was putting my heart to the horses that made me know the sorrow of horses, made me forsake my thumbs for the sheen of unshod hooves, and in this way drop my torches, and in this way drop my knives, feel the small song in my chest swell and my coat glisten and twitch, and my face grow long, and these words cast off at last, for the slow, honest tongue of horses.
You are an award-winning poet, but for The Book of Delights, you chose prose, a collection of essays. Why?
I'm interested in doing things I really don't know how to do. And I've written some essays, but I haven't written lots of essays. So I think that was part of the exciting thing about this, I was like, oh, this will be a fun thing to learn, a fun thing to sort of stumble around in.
What would you like visitors to come away with from your event next week?
I would be glad if to some extent people felt maybe even more inclined to sort of recognize the sweetness of our daily lives and crucially how interdependent we are.
It has been a delight to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Author and poet Ross Gay spoke to us 3 months ago about his collection of short essays, The Book of Delights. There's a link to more information about the book and the author at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cast. It's a delight that you're with us on The Record. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.